And tonight, it's Linda Moulton Howe's turn. She'll be with us for two special hours of reports on various Earth mysteries, high strangeness, as she calls it, and then conversations with Linda when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe is with us from earthfiles.com with a number of great stories she's done some work on for us since the last time we talked with her about a month ago. Hey, Linda, how are you?
Hi, George. I understood that you saw something really strange at the MUFON conference.
I may have seen two unidentified flying objects, Linda, through the night vision goggles of a fellow by the name of Ed Grimsley, who's going to be our guest tomorrow night for the first hour. And I got to tell you, it was strange. It was very unusual seeing these objects up there among the stars darting all over the place. Really was something.
And it was an infrared or Starscope?
Starscope, I believe. Starscope.
And were they round, square, oval, what?
They were round. They were a bit out of focus. We had to decide if they were insects. They were not. And they're under control by something because, you know, unlike a straight satellite or a meteorite, which just goes and disappears, these things went all over the place, came back, stopped, light would go out, went back on, went off again. Truly remarkable. Now, Ed Grimsley believes there's some kind of space war going on, Linda. I wouldn't go that far yet, but I saw two very strange objects up there.
Well, my first story tonight sort of relates to both of those
okay,
ideas.
Okay, let's hear it.
That involves Nazi Germany, Hitler, and probably most of your audience in Coast has heard about Die Glocke, which was the strange bell in various shapes in Germany.
Oh, right. That's right.
That were they non-human technology, back-engineered technology, and we had one war, and what happened to Die Glocke, and what could be up in the skies? Well, recently, I read a new book published in July this month that documents surprising links between Adolf Hitler's Third Reich in Germany and America's banks, business owners, political power brokers, and wars past and present. Reich means empire, and Hitler's Third Reich rose from 1933 to 1945, the end of World War II. Well, the new book is entitled The Rise of the Fourth Reich, and it's by New York Times bestselling author Jim Mars. Jim has been tracking down facts and trying to make sense of American political history since his college days as a journalism major at the University of North Texas in Denton. He graduated in 1966 and began a newspaper reporting and editing career at the Denton Record Chronicle, the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, where he was an investigative reporter, cartoonist, and earned photography awards. And by 1988, Jim decided that he had to put his big file about President John F. Kennedy's assassination into a book that he called Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy. 2 months after its release in 1989, Jim received a call from Hollywood film director Oliver Stone, who wanted to option Crossfire for the movie that became JFK. Jim began asking book editors what they thought was the next big secret government cover-up beyond the JFK assassination. Everyone told him UFOs. That's what led Jim to write his 1997 book, Alien Agenda, which has become the top-selling nonfiction UFO book in the world. Next came Rule by Secrecy in 2000. And this links the money-power elite of America with the money-power elite of Europe back to the money-power elite of Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Iran and Iraq. According to Sumerian cuneiform tablets, Mesopotamia was controlled and manipulated by non-humans called Anunnaki that had their own agendas on this planet. And after American buildings, planes, and lives were destroyed on September 11, 2001, Jim did his own research and became convinced there were other truths beyond the official government version, and he wrote The Terror Conspiracy, published in 2006, followed in 2007 by Psi Spies, The True Story of America's Psychic Warfare Program. Now, in this newest book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, Jim Mars lays out in great detail with names, places, and dates his assertion that Hitler's National Socialism, that was the name of the party that was shortened to Nazi, did not die at the end of World War II because protégés of Hitler had spread corporate front companies around the world. Further, the United States imported Hitler's best rocket scientists in Project Paperclip to test V-2 rockets at the missile White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico. Even current President George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, was intimately connected in the 1930s to 1940s with the powers that represented the Rockefellers and Rothschild banking and business interests that were also involved in the creation and growth of Hitler and his Nazi party. In late 1942, the U.S. government actually prosecuted Prescott Bush under the Trading with the Enemy Act because he was handling money for German steel magnate Fritz Thyssen, who was helping to finance the rise of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Third Reich. Creating wars for profit and stripping civilian liberties are Nazi goals. Jim Mars warns that is already happening in the United States.
Today, almost every thinking person agrees that the United States is off on the wrong path. Somehow we've gotten off on the wrong foot. We've taken a wrong turn. We're into dangerous waters that are in many ways contrary to the liberties and freedom that this country was built on. Well, what I've done in my new book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, is to document and show that we can all agree to point the finger at the one group that it's still politically correct to vilify, and that is Nazis.
And what in July of 2008 are the biggest similarities between Adolf Hitler's Third Reich of World War II and modern America?
Well, we see the erosion of individual liberties. If you say anything that's unpopular, you even risk jail and fine. And we also see that Hitler, when he invaded Poland, he didn't want to upset the German people by calling up general conscription, so he used reserve troops to start World War II, just like we're using our reserve troops to fight imperial wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Then you come up through the similarities and parallels between the burning of the Reichstag and the Enabling Act with the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the rapid passage of the Patriot Act and the creation of Homeland Security. The parallels are all there. The big difference in modern America and Nazi Germany is that in Germany of the 1930s, the state gained control over the corporations. Today in modern America, we see that the corporations have gained control over the state, but the end result is the same.
And under this current administration, we still don't even have a restoration of habeas corpus, which means any American citizen can be arrested without charge stated.
That's right. That's why we no longer have a republic. What we now have is a Fourth Reich, somebody in position of power, the president, the attorney general, the head of Homeland Security, can simply point the finger at you, designate you as an undesirable, hence an enemy combatant, and they can grab you and imprison you, and you don't even get a day in court, much less a lawyer. They have systematically stripped the United States of its fundamental constitutional rights, and that's bad enough, but what really concerns me is that so many people refuse to look at that. They do not want to admit that. They do not want to see it. And so they're allowing it to take place and to continue.
And I thought one of the greatest ironies in your entire book, when you say, quote, today's terrorist groups can be traced right back to the Nazis.
Right. Osama bin Laden was recruited into the Muslim Brotherhood back in the 70s. And Muslim Brotherhood was created in Egypt in the 1930s, but then by the late 30s had been pretty well taken over by a Nazi organization. The creator of the Muslim Brotherhood was a great admirer of Hitler and provided him the means of taking over this violent brotherhood.
And isn't it true that Alan Dulles, then director of the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States in the 1950s, arranged to have these Nazis of the Muslim Brotherhood transferred to Saudi Arabia?
That's correct. During the war, any serviceman who served in North Africa would probably agree that we had as much problem with the Arabs there as we had with the Nazis. And that's because the Arabs, through the Muslim Brotherhood, had aligned themselves with the Nazis. But we managed to overcome that. We defeated them in World War II. So the Muslim Brotherhood was then picked up by the British intelligence at the end of the war. But then, a short time later, it was passed along to our CIA, which at that time was then headed by Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower, the two Dulles brothers were the attorneys for Cromwell and Sullivan, which were the law firm that represented the Schroeder Bank and the Rockefeller Schroeder Investment Corporation and the very nexus of business connections that supported the Nazis. So they were instrumental in bringing Nazis over to the United States under paperclip and other programs at the end of the war and whitewashing their Nazi records. And this is what put a huge nucleus of National Socialists right into our military-industrial complex, where it's spread out and is trying to gain control today.
Isn't it true that by 1979, the Central Intelligence Agency took the Saudi Nazi Muslim Brotherhood to Afghanistan to fight with the Soviets, and they became the Mujahideen, which in the modern world today are one and the same as Al-Qaeda?
That's absolutely correct. When we took the Muslim Brotherhood into Afghanistan in the 80s to fight against the Russian incursion there, the Muslim Brotherhood had already attained a pretty bad name. They were originally thrown out of Egypt by Gamal Nasser because of their violence, but they were predominantly Wahhabi Muslims. And as a result, they were taken in by Saudi Arabia. And this is still the predominant faction in Saudi Arabia today. And of course, this is where Osama bin Laden entered the picture. And then after the Soviets left Afghanistan during the Clinton years, when we had the war in Kosovo, we find that it was the Al-Qaeda that was funding and training the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was the faction that the United States supported. So we can see that the CIA certainly was involved with, if not controlled, Al-Qaeda all the way up until the Bush II administration, which I think should cause every thinking person to take a very serious second look at the attacks of 9/11. I don't think it was about oil. Personally, I think it had more to do with the looting of the Iraqi National Museum, because I have in my files news articles from the Associated Press and European media in 1999 through 2001 speaking of amazing new discoveries being made in Iraq by French and German archaeological teams, which I find very, very fascinating, because it was, after all, France and Germany who were probably most opposed to our invasion of Iraq. And of course, when we decided to attack Iraq in the spring of 2003, we violated normal military tactics, which is to seize an objective, consolidate your winnings, and then move on to the next objective. We simply made a beeline for Baghdad, which is one of the reasons we're having so much problem still over there, is because we failed to pacify the countryside. And instead, we went straight to Baghdad, and despite assurances to World Museum directors by the Pentagon that the Iraqi National Museum would be protected, it was not, and there was wholesale looting. And according to Colonel Matthew Bogdanos, who investigated the Iraqi museum looting for General Tommy Franks, he described the looting of the basement as an inside job. He said that there were guards conveniently missing. They had keys to some of the locked vaults. They knew exactly what they were looking for. They bypassed expensive-looking fakes. They went right for the new uncataloged stuff. And what would this be? Why would they have such an interest in this ancient artifact? Because this was all coming from the cradle of human civilization, the Sumerian civilization. And on the Sumerian tablets, we find not only accounts of extraterrestrial visitation on this planet, but we also find, perhaps, the secrets of energy manipulation at the atomic and subatomic levels, the very thing that the Nazis were working on with their Bell project, which was a device that created counter-rotating energy and magnetic fields, which then theoretically could lead to anti-gravity, flying saucers, star portals, time and interdimensional gateways, time travel, a lot of real science fiction-y sounding things.
And George, we will pick up with Jim in the next half hour about the Bell and the strange craft. And I just wanted to make a note of something that I have found where some researchers of German history have reported that as early as the 1920s, the German secret society called Tool was trying, according to their records, to create an interdimensional machine that they had this very long name for that translates from the German to other world flight machine. That 1920s. The mysteries are layered and layered and layered. The deeper I get into research about the history of Germany as it relates to what happened with the flourishing of the Nazi Third Reich.
What an amazing story and researcher Jim Mars is, huh, Linda?
Oh, yes. I've known Jim for years. He is really a good friend, and he is a guy who goes out after a question in his mind with intense curiosity and a mind that is razor sharp, and he goes for what I consider to be the underbelly of some of the Earth mysteries. There are beautiful Earth mysteries. There are troubling Earth mysteries. And then there are those mysteries that are tied into the political and bloodlines of the evolution on this Earth, in which power has seemed to have certain advantages and priorities, and that same power seems to extend itself from generation to generation through the centuries. And this is part of what Jim has been able to dig around in his books. They especially rule by secrecy, which goes all the way back to Mesopotamia and comes up to the modern world in terms of those power and bloodlines. And now, in the rise of the Fourth Reich, when you read this book, and you are reading facts and tremendously long bibliographies Jim provided in the book, you realize that some of the same exact names that are in power today, that have had power through this century and into the last century, were tied into some of the same banking and business concerns that were helping our enemy.
What's in store next half hour, Linda?
We're going to hear him talk about Die Glock, the bell.
All right, because let me tell you, that is going to be one remarkable moment, because the work that Jim Mars does is second to none, other than maybe second to you, Linda.
Oh, thank you.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe and her fascinating discussion with Jim Mars. Linda, the technology that Jim Mars is about to talk with us about, how close do you think the Germans came to implementing it? Because if they did, I'm not so sure we would have won the war.
Well, your question is a really good one, and it shows how confusing that period of history is, and it shows really how confusing the entire UFO phenomena is in terms of agenda, motive, and interaction with humans that usually does not make sense to humans. And this really raises itself in something that back in the 1990s, I was contacted by a Coast to Coast listener then who said that his father was very ill with diabetes and might not live long, And he wanted me to know that his father had worked for the CIA in the early 1950s on extraterrestrial matters. And a meeting was arranged, and the father told me that he had read with his own eyes in the basement archive of the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley, Virginia, documents dated as early as the 1920s about mysterious disc-shaped craft in Germany. And one document he told me was a communique from British intelligence to American intelligence. There was no CIA then. It was a report of round machines rising silently from the Pienemunde, Germany region. And the British were asking the Americans if anyone had any idea what they were.
Jeez.
Yeah. And the CIA man told me it was his understanding that those silent rising round machines were advanced craft. Now, he said operated by a humanoid intelligence, i.e. not German humans. That, he said, was Hitler's secret, technologies from non-humans. And Pienemunde was where the Third Reich was trying to produce. This is historic fact, what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
It was trying to produce in Pienemunde what everybody described as a bell-shaped craft, but there were so many variations on the shapes that saying bell, the shapes change all over the place. But the bottom line was that they were trying to produce a craft that would neutralize gravity and turn into a lifting body that might also affect time. Now, Jim Mars writes about this
okay. In
his new book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich.
Well, he's one of the best, so let's pick it up with your second report.
One of the most fascinating sections in your book is in Chapter 3, entitled Nazi Wonder Weapons. The bell did exist. Explain what the bell was to Hitler's Nazis and why it is linked to time travel.
Well, the bell is simply called the bell because it was kind of a bell-shaped object. This object had an outer chamber, inner chamber, and created electromagnetic energy fields that were set into rotation movement, and then one layer would rotate clockwise, the other layer would rotate counterclockwise. And in doing this, it increased the power and the efficiency of this energy field generator. And in doing so, there was just some very unusual properties that was experienced. Plants sometimes either blossomed and grew or withered and died. People would die around this thing. This plays into some of the stories that we've heard from other sectors, such as the infamous Philadelphia experiment. This was experiments with energy that apparently altered the whole composition of material objects, including people.
Today, in 2008, given the fact that you and I and others have been exposed to a lot of information about what Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso of our own Army described as extraterrestrial biological entities, do you think that there is any hard evidence that Germany, as early as the 1920s, had non-human intelligence help either building these craft or that they are literally non-human craft that were placed underground in the Pienemunde region of Germany and led to the advanced technologies of the Hitler Reich?
Well, that's a real fascinating question, Linda, and I try to address that in my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. For years, I'd heard stories that the Nazis had captured a flying disc or a flying saucer and had back-engineered it. And yet, every time you try to track those stories, they seem to just peter out. And what I and several other researchers are now coming to the conclusion is that beginning in the 19-teens and into the 1920s, just like in America, in Germany, there was a resurgence of interest in spiritualism and in the occult, and we can trace Hitler and some of his handlers directly into these occult societies, such as the Vril and the Thule Gesellschaft or the Thule Society. And what seems to have happened is that in an early day version of remote viewing, or perhaps what we would call channeling, they did come into contact with non-human intelligences, which then this contact then provided them with clues, if not direct knowledge, of technology that was far beyond what the Allies were able to come up with. And, of course, this is one of the key explanations for how the Nazis were able to continue on after World War II.
Do you have anything that you feel supports strongly the allegation that the Bell was truly extraterrestrial technology made by tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed humanoids, and that that was why Hitler had an obsession about a super race of tall, blonde, blue-eyed people?
Well, I think that is probably would fall under the category of conjecture, but I think it's informed conjecture. There's no question that Hitler, who was kind of short and dark-haired, and, you know, certainly did not match the Aryan Superman. Nevertheless, he and his SS were obviously just fixated on the idea of the tall, blonde, blue-eyed Nordic Aryan. Now, where did that come from? So I think the supposition that it may have come from their channeling or remote viewing experiences with these Nordic EDs, as has been described by numerous experiencers, I think that may indeed be valid, but we really don't have any hard proof of that.
And that the Bell that Nazi Hitler Germany had at Peenemünde might be truly an example of extraterrestrial biological entity technology?
ET technology, that's true. And the difference here is that in discussing the tall Nordic blonde ETs, all we have are narratives. There does not seem to be any hard evidence of their existence. And yet, when it comes to the Nazi Bell, we have living witnesses who were involved in that project who have described it. We have the physical remains of some of the testing facilities. The ruins are still there. They're very real. They do exist. And so there is actually a whole lot more solid support for the idea of the Nazi Bell technology than there is for the tall, blonde Aryan ETs.
And why was the Bell linked to time travel?
Well, because when you get these counter-rotating vortex energy fields, apparently it can negate gravity. And, of course, anti-gravity is something that we've been searching for a very long time. And then apparently what happens is that if you negate gravity, that currently you are negating time. And this gets back into the missing time element within so many of the UFO sighting reports. People say, well, I saw this UFO at 6 o'clock, and I didn't get home till 7, and yet it's only a 10-minute drive. You know, what happened to the missing time? Well, it's because when you enter the energy field, well, let's put it this way. It's well known within the literature that when a UFO comes over, the car stops, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when it moves away, the car starts again. Nobody ever talks about turning on the starter or turning the key or hitting the starter, and it goes right. It stops, and then it starts. And that's because when the energy field surrounds the car, time stops, as well as the gravity which is holding the ship up. And the pistons, which are pounding away in the engine, freeze. They just stop because time has stopped. And then when the energy field moves off, the pistons go back to banging again, the car motor's running again. So this is the correlation between gravity and time. So if you have this ET technology that can negate gravity, then you can also negate time, which indicates you might be able to move within time, which raises the distinct possibility of time travel. We're talking about the Bell Project, which definitely existed. And we're talking about some of the theoretical effects of the Bell, but the main problem is that much is not known about it. It's all been kept top secret, and I personally believe that the secrets of the Bell are still in certain files accessible by certain globalist factions today. I notice I did not say the U.S. government, because the U.S. government implies your local IRS agent, your postman, and, you know, your local representatives, and they don't have a clue. No, this power of technology is being very, very kept close to the chest by the people who see it as the means to power and control.
What is your greatest fear going forward from July 2008?
I don't think that there is any easy remedy for Washington, D.C. It's so out of control, so overbloated, so convoluted, so corrupt, that there's not going to be any way short of just a massive march on Washington and tell everybody to go get a real job, and that ain't going to happen.
So what is the fate of the United States?
Well, I do think we're kind of at a crossroads, and I think it's going to be a foot race to see whether enough people wake up and we begin to take charge of our own lives and our own communities and our own neighborhoods. Hermann Göring at Nuremberg said, getting the people to go along with the leaders is no big deal, no secret. You just tell them they've been attacked, and then you describe anyone who protests as unpatriotic. We see that today. And it's the same methodology. They're using the same thing on us that they've used all along. And it worked once before. Why won't it work now? And unfortunately, it is because people do not learn from history. And when you don't learn from history, then as philosopher George Santayana said, you're doomed to repeat it. And we are repeating it.
And he found a very interesting New York Times article, George, that's dated December 13th, 1944. And this was news that was authorized by the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force. And the title, the headline was, Floating Mystery Ball is New Nazi Air Weapon. This is the headline in the New York Times on December 13, 1944, and then the article says, airmen of the American Air Force report that they are encountering silver-colored spheres in the air over German territory. The spheres are encountered either singly or in clusters. Sometimes they are semi-translucent. The new device, apparently an air defense weapon, resembles the huge glass balls that adorn Christmas trees. There was no information available as to what holds them up, like the stars in the sky, what is in them, or what their purpose is supposed to be, unquote, New York Times. Well, Jim goes on with another fascinating report from an author, Renato Vesco, about the Foo Fighters, quote, actually being the Führerball, or fireball of the Nazis, which, quote, a highly original flying machine, circular and armored, more or less resembling the shell of a tortoise, and was powered by a special turbojet engine, also flat and circular, whose principles of operation generated a great halo of luminous flames. Radio controlled at the moment of takeoff, it then automatically followed enemy aircraft, attracted by their exhaust flames, and approached close enough without collision to wreck their radar gear. And Vesco claims that later these symmetrical circular aircraft became known as the Kugelblitz, or ball lightning. And the fact that there are, George, these different descriptions, even by people who have studied the history and have studied newspaper reports, and the fact that at one point it's translucent, another it is not translucent, in other descriptions it is metallic, in other descriptions the shapes are changing, then leaves the door hugely open. How many different types of craft were underground at Peenemünde, Germany, and which were back engineered, and which might truly have been from the obsession that Adolf Hitler had, which were tall, blue-eyed, blonde, non-human.
What a great story. Absolutely great. When you were with Mars talking about this, was there anything there that he said, Linda, that shocked you beyond belief?
No, because Jim and I have shared so much over such a long period of time. Well, I'll put it this way. I was surprised as an investigative reporter who has not done, as Jim has through his career, focused on the political history of the United States and our political entanglements with other nations. When you read Jim Marr's The Rise of the Fourth Reich, and you are seeing the dates, the names, references, I have been spending so much time on the Googling various subjects and finding that Jim has laid it out in such a nice way, but you can keep going deeper and deeper and wider and broader, and you realize that the power structure of the elite minority that is on this planet today extends back over decades and generations. It's the names such as Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current sitting president, who was involved with banking, financing, ocean liners, a variety of businesses that were involved with a man who was financing the rise of the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler. Now, that in and of itself, the fact that, yes, he was prosecuted under that act, you can't consort with an enemy. He was prosecuted, and people can say, well, that does not mean that there is any direct connection between the corruption of what was happening between the businesses and the banks of Germany and the United States and other countries at the time. However, we find ourselves today in a country that is no longer what it was a decade ago in so many ways, of which the loss of habeas corpus right now stuns me as much as anything that has ever happened. I cannot believe that this has not been restored. And when Jim and I were talking about the astonishments are that we are living in a time when our country is changing so rapidly, and it scares a lot of us. And you go back to the 1930s when the Third Reich was rising. And what were its goals? The goals were to foster wars for political and monetary gain, and in the process to strip the civilian population from having rights, because then the population is much more manageable and controllable by the government powers that are setting. And nobody in the United States, as Jim says, no one wants this to be true. People don't want to even hear the comparisons with historic events. And yet, George, if we don't study, if we don't become aware, if we don't have consciousness that might help us put our feet in the sand and say, no, the United States of America is not going to go the way of Hitler's Reich.
We'll be back with more with Linda Moulton Howe in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. This Stephenville, Texas UFO case, Linda, continues to be one of the strangest stories I've ever heard.
And increasing in strength of hard data.
Yes.
You know, back in early January to February, it's now a little bit more than a half a year, there were a series of unidentified aerial lights and strange craft, and they were reported by dozens of eyewitnesses in the Stephenville, Dublin, and Selden region, which is southwest of Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, about 3 hours by car. And one especially active date, even though this went on from at least the 1st of January till about February 13th, January 8th stood out, starting around 6 p.m. Central Time, with the first three eyewitnesses sitting on a hill in Selden, southeast of Stephenville and straight west of Dublin. And one of those eyewitnesses was Steve Allen, who is a pilot and a businessman, and he's a longtime resident of nearby Glen Rose, and he's accustomed to watching civilian and military air traffic, but he told me that he had never seen anything like the aerial display on January 8th. And you all listening can see sketches by Steve Allen along with maps, graphics, and radar data at my news website, www.earthfiles.com, in my reports that are up there tonight about this radar and the discoveries. And what happened in Selden, the details are there at Earth Files, and what we're going to focus on tonight are the radar data. And the fact that it's very interesting that Steve said that two F-16 jets came roaring toward the lights in front of him and his two colleagues with afterburners on high and gave chase. And there were several other UFO eyewitness reports that night until at least 8 p.m. Central, and they were reported by Angela Joyner when she worked for the Stephenville Empire Tribune, and all of this news quickly spread to TV networks and beyond to international headlines. Well, one man in Littleton, Colorado, was following all of this Stephenville, Texas phenomena. He's Glenn Schultz, a semi-retired radar specialist. Glenn received a BS degree in electrical engineering from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri in 1952.
Great university.
It is. And then Glenn was drafted into the U.S. Army from September 1952 to 1954, and he was assigned to assist in the test and evaluation of the chain radar network at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. A decade later, from 1965 to 71, he worked at Cape Canaveral for the NASA Apollo program, in which he produced reentry instrumentation records. As Apollo closed down, Glenn went to work for Martin Marietta in Littleton, Colorado, in support of Skylab, the first space station the United States launched into orbit from 73 to 79. And Glenn supported the tape recording of key instrumentation of the data that Skylab was sending back in sensors for science reports about the studies of the sun and effects of microgravity. Well, Glenn knows that on January 8, 2008, the Federal Aviation Administration's radar beacons, designed to help air traffic controllers reduce air congestion around airports, they would have received whatever transponder beacon signals were sent from normal civilian and military aircraft in the greater Dallas-Fort Worth and Stephenville region. And Glenn also knew that FAA radar tapes can be erased and reused within 14 days. So if he was going to get any usable data, it was urgent that he file a Freedom of Information Act request immediately after what he heard January 8th was a big night. Glenn mailed his FOIA request on January 16th, 2008, for data from the five air route traffic control center antennas that were within 250 nautical miles of Stephenville. And he received back 2.5 million radar data returns.
2.5 million.
Yeah. Now, to help analyze all this data and compare it to the many January 8, 2008 eyewitness accounts of this strange aerial phenomenon, MUFON Research Director Robert Powell joined in the effort. Robert, 54, received a BS in chemistry from Southeastern Oklahoma State University in 1976. He worked in the semiconductor industry for almost 30 years. Both men wanted to know if the FAA radar data would produce what are called skin paint tracks of unknown objects, and an unknown would not be using transponders that beep. So by definition, in this research, an unknown object, it's giving out a skin paint on radar, but it is not beeping like all of the civilian and most of the military traffic. If there were unknowns, then Robert Powell wanted to study their latitude and longitude data to calculate speeds, directions, and timelines to compare them with all these eyewitness accounts. And after hundreds of research hours, this month of July, Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell released their formal report through MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and it confirms they did find FAA radar unknowns that do not match up to any known civilian or military aircraft between 4 and 8 p.m. on January 8, 2008, the time period for which they asked in their FOIA request. Now, one unknown traveled for nearly an hour very slowly on a straight track toward the President George W. Bush Ranch in Crawford, Texas, east of Stephenville. And recently, I talked with Glenn and Robert about their radar research, that straight line unknown object, and what provoked Glenn to file his FOIA requests so rapidly back in January 2008.
The first thing that drove me in that direction was Major Carl Lewis at the Carswell Air Force Base installation saying within 2 days that they had no airplanes in the air. And I said, wait a minute, this sounds like Roswell all over again. Here we have people on the ground saying they're seeing all this activity, and the Air Force is saying, oh, we didn't have anything in the air. So I said, if there's anything in the air, the FAA radar is going to show it. And so I went out and I FOIA'd on two different FAA facilities, the Air Route Traffic Control Center in Fort Worth, which is responsible for all of Texas plus adjoining states with about 16 different rotating antennas. And I sent in a second standalone FOIA to the Dallas-Fort Worth TRACON staff. These are the people that are right at the DFW runways controlling the landings and the takeoffs of the airplane.
You received data then from how many radar towers?
I received data from 5 completely different FAA antenna towers, and that totaled up to over 2.5 million returns. I had also requested 5 additional and different antenna data, which I did not get.
Do you understand why you didn't get any of that data?
I can tell you what they told me. They told me that my TRACON request had arrived too late at their technical staff and that the data was no longer available. They did not say the data had been recorded over. They said the data is no longer available, which made me a little unhappy because both of my FOIAs, the one that succeeded from the center, which got me 2.5 million data returns, and the second one, which got me nothing, both went out in the same envelope of transmittal on the same date, 8 days after the event. So 2 different, completely standalone FOIAs. One succeeded, one didn't.
Is it correct that you acted so quickly because you knew that in many cases radar tapes would be erased and reused and you wanted to act before the 14 days were up?
Exactly.
Describe when you first realized that you were dealing with unknowns.
Probably 2 to 3 months into the exercise, it was a very difficult task, not only because of the volume of returns we had, but the fact that we had an equal number of beacon returns that were being received from cooperative airplanes in the air that had beacons, that when they got scanned from the ground, the beacon went back and said, here I am, here's my 4-digit PIN number.
And this is what comes from the transponders in civilian and military planes?
Yes, the transponder is what answers the sweeping antenna from the ground, and it says, here I am, I want to be identified, here's my altitude, here's my code number. Don't lose track of me, guys, I'm cooperating with you. That's called a secondary or a transponder beacon return. Half of our returns were of that type. The other half of the returns were uncooperative, unbeaconed targets, which we got skin paint returns from, but no help, no beacons, no PIN numbers, no altitudes. So I had a real task of trying to sift through all of this to try and see where are there unknowns over Stephenville that I should zero in on. And that took me about 2.5 months.
What was the first thing that excited you?
The fact that the unknowns were at the right time of day, they were in the right latitude and longitude, and for over an hour, we got almost 200 returns from an unknown, unbeaconed, unidentified device, all in a straight line ground track headed to the southeast over Stephenville.
Glenn Schultz's colleague in the FAA radar analysis is 54-year-old Robert Powell, a chemist retired from the semiconductor industry. Robert lives in Austin, Texas, and is currently director of research for the Mutual UFO Network. Robert studied the FAA radar data to see if he could match any of it to eyewitness descriptions and timelines. Between 6:15 p.m. and 6:51 p.m., he found several eyewitnesses in addition to Steve Allen and his friends that correlated with unknowns. And like Glenn, Robert was surprised by the unknown object that traveled from south of Dublin in a straight line.
And this object we actually track on radar for over an hour. And this is the one that, if you continue tracking it, by 8 o'clock, it is within 10 miles of the Crawford Ranch.
So that's only 25 minutes after the Steve Allen and his colleague sighting in Selden.
Yes, that's approximately 25 minutes after his sighting. The only thing I can say is that the object I tracked for an hour is on a straight line course. Now, it disappears off radar occasionally during that one-hour period, but its course is always constant. The average speed is around 44 to 49 miles per hour. That's very slow. Now, there is one time on radar where the object clocking it between every 10-second radar sweep. At one point in time, it's at 532 miles an hour, and 10 seconds later, it's at 49 miles an hour. The only one that might be able to do that in a 10-second time frame would be either a Harrier-type jet, or I believe the new F-35s have Harrier-type jet capabilities. But the problem would be to maintain a slow speed for over an hour. I would think they would run out of fuel, but I'm not an expert on those type of aircraft.
Any aircraft that is low and traveling at 49 miles an hour, you would assume would make quite a bit of noise that would have been heard by everyone, and yet everyone's report is that everything they saw was completely silent.
Right. We only have one witness, and that was the lady who was near Alexander. When she saw it, she heard nothing.
What about tracks going to the Crawford Ranch?
Our main thought was there's an object moving in that direction. What would be the reaction of the military aircraft? And, of course, we looked at that, and we didn't see any reaction from them. So that was probably the most surprising part to us. Whether this object is military aircraft, civilian aircraft, or whatever it is, it just seems strange that they would not react. So that either indicates they already know what it is and they're not concerned, or they have not seen it on the F-16's radar.
In a time of war in which national security from any kind of terrorist attacks is this administration's stated highest priority, how could there be these unknowns flying around in the air from 6:15 p.m. to 8 p.m. when your data ends without military response, especially at the Crawford Bush compound?
That's a very good question, one which I don't have an answer to. In our report, we believe there's probably an AWACS aircraft in the area during this entire time frame. We found an object that maintained an altitude of about 41,000 feet, which is higher than most of your civilian aircraft fly. It was there for the entire time we have our radar data, and it's flying figure eight over the area, going as far north as North Texas to as far south as north of the Austin area. And those aircraft have the capability of seeing down with radar for 250 miles. Those type of aircraft are used whenever you're trying to control. I mean, they're like a flying headquarters, basically.
Your implication is if it's a flying headquarters, that somebody might have had knowledge of something in that Stephenville Crawford area that needed to be observed during that period of 4 to 8 p.m. on January 8, 2008?
What I can say is I would think that if that was an AWACS, they would have seen all objects in that area. I think there's sufficient data here between radar and the witness accounts to establish enough likelihood that we have unknown objects that the government should look at this and provide an answer to the public.
And why doesn't our Congress, why does no one in what is considered a position of public authority pay serious attention to this data and call Glenn and call Robert and say, we want information. We want to know what is happening. Why were there no military jets responding in an area where the President of the United States has a compound? And Glenn told me that it has been the lack of communication by people who are in authority of some kind that you would think would follow up with them on this, and they have not. And you know, silence often means the people in authority have a lot more knowledge, and they are keeping their mouths shut because there's a policy of denial in the interest of national security. And I think that it is one of the most significant discoveries in all of this research is what appears to be an airborne early warning and control. That's what an AWACS is, at 41,000 feet. During that entire 4 to 8 p.m. time period that they had the radar data, doing figure eights from northern Texas up in the Panhandle down to northern Austin and covering that area at 41,000 feet. And when you go and do some research about what do we have in the AWACS inventory, there is a what is called the U.S. Air Force E-3 Sentry. And this is a plane that is used to guard the air. And with its rotating radar, which is the mushroom that you see in the photographs, it can reach hundreds of miles into the air for what they're looking for is enemy aircraft. And if an enemy plane is detected, friendly fighter planes will be guided toward the enemies by the radar operators that are in this AWACS. Well, it was up there. There were all of these citizens on January 8th who were reporting to authorities there. Glenn and Robert have radar unknowns now, skin paints, that match a lot of those eyewitnesses. And yet that one peculiar object going from 500 and some miles an hour down to 47 to 49 miles an hour on a straight line for a little over an hour to the Crawford compound, the Bush compound.
Mm-hmm.
No jets. What? Why? What in the world does it mean? That's what we would all like answers to, because when it comes to this strange high strangeness of what have to be called unidentified flying objects that were definitely all over the Stephenville region, maybe somebody in that AWACS at 41,000 feet either knew something was up or they were monitoring.
When we come right back, Linda will talk in depth about that magnetic-type rock that was found near Roswell, New Mexico. You remember that story we talked about? Well, she's done an in-depth investigation into this very strange carved rock. Back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, we talked about this incredible rock that had this carving in it a couple weeks ago. Truly a remarkable story, so I'm glad that you have covered this now in depth.
Yeah, I even went down there and held it in my hand and all of this testing and talked with Robert Ridge and scientists, and it goes back almost 4 years ago now. It was September 4th, 2004, and Robert Ridge is a self-employed auto shop owner. He's lived in Roswell all of his life, and he likes to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided to go bow and arrow hunting for deer in what is called the Cedar Hill region near Capitan Mountain. It's well known to deer hunters there. And it's about 17 miles southeast of the alleged UFO crash of a wedge-shaped aerial vehicle between Corona and Roswell now some 61 years ago in the July 4th to July 6th, 1947 period. And Robert Ridge has gone into the Cedar Hill area many times. He's about 50 years old now. So this was something he has done many times. And he was following hoof tracks on a trail, thinking that they were deer, and his head was down as he's intently watching the tracks in front of him. That's what he's staring at. When a brownish red rock caught his attention only about 12 feet away.
I've got my head down, you know, looking at the tracks, and I look over and notice this rock. And I could kind of see a design on it, you know, from probably maybe 10 or 12 feet from me. But I didn't pick it up right then. I went ahead with what I was doing. Turns out that what I was tracking was actually goats. When I found that out, you know, I thought, well, maybe I should go pick up that rock. So I went back and found it. That was probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on September 4th of 04.
When you picked up the rock, what was your first reaction?
Just curiosity. I was kind of taken back by the design and was just really kind of awestruck by it. It was quite dirty. I got it back to the truck and brushed it off and was just started examining it, you know, in the sunlight. And the first thought that came to my mind was that it looked like it had been done by the finger of God. That was my first impression of it, because I couldn't understand how anybody else could have done it.
the fact that that pattern seems to be three-dimensionally lifted up from the surface of this hard rock is extraordinary.
Yes, it's been taken away. You know, everything around it has been taken away to expose that up out of it. And it has some beveling. Instead of just a 90-degree cut, you know, down, some of the circles have like a 90-degree backside where it's straight up and straight down, and then the front of the circle comes like down to a 45.
Right. And it looks sculpted.
We had a sculptor look at it. She had no idea how it could be sculpted or reproduced herself. So it's pretty much a question mark right now. The first time we ever put a magnet to it, I saw that it was reactive to the magnet.
In what way?
It spins. The rock will spin when you hold a magnet over the top of it, like over one circle. It spins counterclockwise. And then if you hold the magnet over the other side of the other circle, it spins counterclockwise.
You found this rock on September 4th, 2004, in the afternoon while you were bow hunting deer.
Correct.
And we have not learned about this until 2008, July. So what held you back over those 4 years?
Well, I knew that it was something special. And I kept it to myself basically for personal reasons. Because I fell in love, I guess you could say, with it, and I didn't really want to share it with people. I'm a pretty private person. I was trying to prepare myself and get all my ducks in a row for what might happen when I did finally show it to the public, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want people to think that I was in it for monetary gain. That's basically why I've waited this long.
What do you say to people who say, oh, this must be a hoax, this is something that somebody has planted for publicity because it looks like the 1996 crop formation?
Well, I've had that already. I just say to them that, unfortunately, I was by myself that day when I found it, but it'd be for them to prove that it's a hoax because we're trying to prove that it's not. We haven't been able to find anybody who could say they could make something like that, and it would be such a fluke, you know, for somebody to plant it and hope that somebody finds it out there in the middle of nowhere. If you planted something like that, it might be 100 years before somebody found it.
If a crop formation was photographed and was available at cropcircleconnector.com to see in August of 1996, why couldn't somebody have copied that and put it on a stone and deposited it in Cedar Hill, New Mexico in 2004?
Well, anything's possible, but very, very improbable as far as we know up to date.
The Cedar Hill and that deer hunting area, how many people in a year might visit there?
Mostly hunters go in there. There's really not a whole lot to see and do in there unless you're hunting. It's probably 40 miles from Roswell.
If this rock had been, let's say, under bushes or even slightly under the dirt from 60 years ago, is there anything about that area that would explain why it might suddenly have been exposed in 2004?
It's a sandy area. You know how the wind blows out here. The sand shifts and, you know, covers and uncovers things on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, in your 50 years, had any interaction with anything that was a disc-shaped craft?
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. It was November 5th. Of 1995, 4:30 in the morning. I remember it like it was yesterday. We were headed out east of town, and that morning was a harvest moon, and it was the most beautiful moonset that I probably ever saw in my life. There's a little valley east of town here, and you have to climb a hill before you can drop off into the valley. And we had just gone over the hill into the valley, into the darkness. And as soon as we popped over the hill, this is about probably 10 miles out of town, from the north, which would be to our left, came a silver object over into the valley with us, kind of. And it was moving at a super high rate of speed, and it was leaving a vapor trail behind it. This vapor trail was probably bigger than the craft itself. Long after the craft was gone, this vapor trail hung in that valley, and it was this brilliant orange color because the moon was still shining on it. And the vapor trail, it was sparkling, like little firecrackers going off in it, like phosphorus burning or something in the vapor trail. It was spectacular. It was something to see. The craft was more of a triangle shape, though.
Okay. When you say triangle, can you describe it in more detail?
Triangle probably wouldn't be good. It was more of a, say, a half diamond type shape. And I believe if the moon hadn't been like it was that morning, that everything would have been silver and white. The vapor trail would have been white and the path would have been silver. But with this harvest moonshine on it, it was all a brilliant orange color.
Okay. And half of a diamond is triangle shaped. The government documents say the objects were not disc shaped that came down in Roswell, east of Alamogordo, and at White Sands. They were wedge shaped.
That would be this, yes. That would be the word I would be looking for.
A piece of pie shape.
Yeah, yeah.
Robert Ridge took his special rock to a Portales, New Mexico lab back in 2004 for X-ray spectroscopy analysis. I called that lab and learned that all the original test results have been later lost in a computer hard disk crash. So on Tuesday, July 15th, 2008, I drove to Portales to meet Robert Ridge, who had his mysterious carved rock. We went to the Physical Sciences Department of Eastern New Mexico University. The chair of that department is geology professor James Constantopoulos, Ph.D., who has taught at ENMU for nearly 20 years. The rock is a dark chocolate color with a touch of red and has a satin smooth finish. It's a bit heart-shaped and only about 2 inches by 1.5 inches. One end is twice as thick as the other. The thickest part is where one of the circle and crescent patterns are, which extend down to another crescent and circle at the thinnest part of the rock. The pattern is very refined, with beveled edges, and seems to rise more than 1/8 of an inch up from the surface of the rock. And most incredibly, the pattern is a match to the extraordinary August 2, 1996 crop formation at Lyttington Castle in Wiltshire, England. That was also the same pattern of two circles and two crescent moons, which has always been on the list of crop formations without any signs of man-made or mechanical damage. Professor Constantopoulos closely examined the front and back of the rock under his binocular optical microscope, watched his pencil magnet click to the side of the rock, which indicated the presence of magnetite, and confirmed with X-ray fluoroscopy that the rock is largely iron and silicon. Robert Ridge placed his own auto-shop magnet over one crescent and circle, and the rock turned clockwise. He moved his magnet to the other crescent and circle, and the rock turned counterclockwise. You can see videotape that I took in the lab of the rock turning in these opposite positions at my news website, earthfiles.com. At the top of the headline page is a hot link to this report that includes the video. Crop formations are also famous for having clockwise and counterclockwise lays of the plants. And I asked Professor Constantopoulos if whoever or whatever made the rock pattern might have intended that one crescent circle turn clockwise and the other turn counterclockwise.
I think it was just selective positioning of the magnet and due to irregularities in the shape of the sample.
And have you seen a variation in clockwise and counterclockwise rotation in other magnetite rocks based only on the shape of the rock?
No, because it's not really something we do. As a geologist, we're only concerned with, is it magnetic or not? And is it strongly magnetic, suggestive of magnetite, or is it weakly magnetic and suggestive of one of the other iron and titanium-bearing minerals? And also to look at the carving itself in detail, to look for any evidence of tool marks or mechanical work on the sample itself.
Or even heating from something like a laser?
Yes, exactly. And it didn't appear to have been formed by a laser. It's too perfect to have been done by hand, and the material is too hard. It really doesn't lend itself well to hand working. But I could see someone with machining experience could possibly produce a pattern like this.
But you didn't find any evidence of how it was made?
No, I did not.
What was your overall impression of this pattern in something like an iron-rich rock?
Very unusual. Obviously, the pattern itself, because it is a duplication of that crop circle, was intriguing. It's not very easily worked material. There are hundreds of other natural materials that would be more easily worked than this material.
And in your professional career, have you ever seen an iron-rich rock similar to this one in which anybody had done any carving the way this is, three-dimensionally growing out of the surface of the rock?
No, I haven't. The rock is remarkable in the presence of this pattern. There was no difference in the body of the rock itself and the carving. All one piece. It doesn't look like it was stamped. That area of the carving was completely consistent with the rest of the rock. And there was really no evidence of how this was made.
You know, George, in my three-part Earth Files about this research with the rock and going back to the August 2nd, 1996 crop formation, it is a absolute match of the pattern, circle and a crescent, a circle and a crescent, each inside of circles with these splaying sort of like arcs or plumes mm-hmm. coming out. But here is a very interesting observation. The Lidington Castle in 1996 on August 2nd, the circle and the crescent are made by standing crop, and then the plants were swirled down around the crescent and the circle so that you can see, like bas-relief, you can see the circle and the crescent. In the rock, think of this very satin-smooth, hard, iron-rich rock that has magnetite in it, and then rising up from the surface of the rock by about an eighth of an inch is this same crop pattern, except in the rock, it rises up, and I took really wonderful, I hope, photos for everybody to see so you can see an actual real color of this rich chocolate at Earth Files while I was down there in the lab. The rock itself, the circle and the crescent, are made by being scooped out, if you want to put it that way, from the raised section of the rock. So it would be like that the rock has the pattern made in such a way that if you could put it down over 120 feet of wheat in England, you would then be sort of making a mold pattern, i.e. the rock is the depressed pattern, and the crop circle back in 1996 is the raised pattern. The crescent in the wheat in England, it's standing wheat. The crescent in the circles in the rock are made by depression. And that is the difference. That if you say, is there a difference? Otherwise, it's identically the same pattern. And it was very interesting to watch Robert Ridge take his auto magnet and put it on one of the circle and crescents, one end of the rock, and the rock would clearly turn one direction. And then he would move it to the other, which I videotaped and is at Earth Files. It's very interesting. Well, it is possible that just the magnetite distribution in the rock itself, which we don't know, we would have to do X-ray analysis of this rock. Robert Ridge does not want to part with this rock, does not want any invasive technique. So I'm now discussing with him the possibility that at least another interesting non-invasive test that we could do would be to work with somebody who is a geophysicist who could experiment with this rock in magnetic fields and under different kinds of magnets. Did you see how sensitive are these spots on the rock, the crescent circles, to actually turning and rotating clockwise or counterclockwise to somebody who isn't Robert Ridge holding his auto magnet? Can this be observed independently by somebody who studies magnetic fields? He's very interested in doing that, and so if we can get that research done, I will report it to you in a future coast, because there is something extraordinary about this rock.
And you don't think it's some kind of Roswell novelty that somebody just threw out there?
Well, he doesn't. And you come back to what the professor said about this being a very difficult rock to work in. And I know that some people have sent me some of their own sandblasting examples and various other kinds of things that people have been trying to do to say, well, this is what I was able to do. But Professor Constantopoulos even brought in a colleague to look at it under the microscope, because they were truly puzzled about how this formation had been made on this hard, iron-rich rock, and they could not find the evidence that they usually would find if they were looking at something that had been handled mechanically.
Up next, we're going to have conversations with Linda Moulton Howe next hour, so get ready to make your phone call to us. We'll give you the numbers in just a moment. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Linda Moulton Howe will take your phone calls this hour. Linda, did you see the story that we had yesterday from the LA Times, where some scientists are beginning to think that Gaucho and Pancho pesticides may be responsible for the billions of bees, the honeybees, that have died or disappeared?
Well, it comes right back to those very first reports that I did last year, including in Coast to Coast, having to do with the concerns about the neonicotinoids and the whole issue of that's one, and then paralleling are the genetically modified, embedded, we'll call it that, pesticides in some of the plants. And Gaucho and these particular pesticides fall into categories of questions that have been there for a long time in terms of the impact they have on the larva. There are a lot of standards that are out there only for adult insects, and I had that discussion with a UC Davis scientist last year, saying that one of his concerns would be that pesticides are being used too much, doubling, tripling, quadrupling, that would even have effect on adults, but would definitely kill larvae.
Okay, let's go to the phones. You're on with Linda Moulton Howe, Richard in California. Hey, Richard, go ahead.
Hey, George, great show as usual.
Thank you.
And Linda, how are you doing?
Hello.
Hi. I had a question. When you were talking about this rock with the crop circles on it, I was wondering, has anybody ever applied a magnet to both sides simultaneously? And has this ever been tested in water? Because you were talking about the gravitational pulls earlier and time travel and all that. I was wondering, is this some kind of tool that could be used for that? Have they tested that?
No, but those are all really interesting questions. And hopefully we are going to be able to do this next step of how does this rock interact with really controlled magnets and magnetic fields. And I will try to find out all of that, magnets on the front and back simultaneously, any effect in water. I think we can do that without any problem to the rock. So whatever we do find, I will report on Earth Files and Coast to Coast in the future.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thanks, George.
You got that. Linda, how often are you traveling now for Earth Files and also for, you know, all these other projects you work on?
Well, it just depends. In this case, I'm in New Mexico, and Robert Ridge is down in Roswell. So going 4 hours down to do that work in the university was definitely worth the time and the effort. And it will be, again, to hook up with a lab, hopefully, and a geophysicist. It really does depend on the substance of a story and what will going to a lab or a scientist or out into the field or gathering samples, what can we learn and is there value in doing it? And that's sort of the screen or the lens that I use to decide how much I'm going to do.
Next up, let's go to east of the Rockies, Stephen in Louisiana. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. Go ahead.
Hi, Linda. I actually spoke with you one of the last times you were on here, and I'm really excited to be able to speak with you again, so pretty honored with that.
Thank you.
I, Certainly, certainly. I wanted to comment on Jim Marr's interview with that with him. The last time I spoke with you, I walked into my library and I pulled one of David Icke's books off the shelf, and I had actually never seen the book before in my life, so it had a bit of a primer on this sort of money connection, the Rothschilds and all of that that arise over the past century. And actually, I'm a this money connection is absolutely insane. I'm wanting to know what you think about the whole debt structure of America, really representing a new sort of indentured servitude, really, you know, something that is significantly part of the Fourth Reich.
Well, that is Jim Marr's huge concern, that we are becoming a country in which it's a tiny, tiny power and money elite that it has most of the resources, controls and manipulates most of the resources. The middle class is becoming poorer and poorer and larger and larger, and that we are not the nation that once upon a time there were sort of, there was like, you can work hard and you can save money and you can have a house and you can put your kids through college and there will be a pension and all of that. We are in a completely different, tumultuous time. I don't know myself at all how this is all going to shake out in this very troubled economic time now. But when you have people who are vulnerable, and Jim has said that leaders who have had goals to control populations, that they do it in certain ways. You make the population weaker economically, and then you scare them with a problem, or you go to war, and then you have a population that is completely dependent upon whoever is in authority for their livelihood and for their security. And when people feel that, a kind of trapped existence underneath the government, that is what Jim is afraid that we are definitely headed in the United States. And I hope, George, when you do another Coast interview with Jim, that you will have him talk not only about these dangerous warning signals that he is seeing, but he feels that there really are ways that the American public now can sort of grab a hold, if you want to say it that way, of their congressional representatives in a very aggressive way and say, here are my concerns. This is, you need to restore habeas corpus. We need to change this Patriot Act. We need to get the United States back onto a constitutional ground like it once was, that we're slipping and sliding supposedly in the context of a fear of terrorist attacks and a war, when in fact, if the motivation for a lot of what is happening is political and power agendas to keep the population of the United States weaker and more dependent on the government, that's not the route that the United States wants to go.
It's amazing, Linda, how the agenda seems to be unfolding for them perfectly.
Exactly. And when you get Jim going, boy, I'm telling you, I think he's had concerns in his life at a lot of levels. And his powerful book, Crossfire, about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, in a very interesting way, dovetails with exactly the whole issue of the becoming of a political system in a country that would kill a president to suppress information and redirect American political policy.
Let's go to Michigan. Alan, you're on with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi, Alan.
Hey, hi, George. I'm in your home state. I'm a truck driver. I'm on my way from Toledo back to Cadillac. I'd like to have a shout-out to my wife. I know she's listening at home.
Okay.
I wanted to ask Linda a similar question to that first caller about the magnetism on that rock, which seemed to me, if it'll spin different directions holding the magnet on each end, that if you hold it directly above it and point it down, it might spin in a circle.
It does definitely keep rotating in one direction. We did this for 20 minutes. The rock will go in a clockwise direction, and it will keep going in a clockwise direction. It isn't something that just happens and it stops.
Oh.
It's very persistent and consistent, and that's why I videotaped And I put a segment as videotape in a link at Earth Files so that people can see this. And it's just a short excerpt, but we did this for a very long time.
Well, maybe if that's some kind of alien message to tell us about some type of magnetic power.
Or it is a natural Earth iron-rich rock that has maybe a moderate amount of magnetite in it distributed in just such a way, which we don't know yet, that moving a magnet from the thick end to the thin end could cause these rotations and the changes in rotations. And here is where there's science and hard repeatable science, which is what I would like to do in a lab with a geophysicist, versus the you might say back to the crop formation world, where clockwise and counterclockwise patterns are what have defined crop formations now for a quarter of a century. So isn't it interesting, even philosophically, that this beautiful, it's really a very beautiful rock, would end up turning clockwise when this magnet is on one end of the pattern and counterclockwise when it's on the other, philosophically and poetically, just in the context of crop formations, that fascinates me around about this rock.
All right, you drive carefully out there in Michigan. Linda, have you, because I haven't talked with you about this for as long as I can remember, but have you ever done any work with Zechariah Sitchin, and what do you think of his theories?
Oh, I met Zechariah Sitchin back in the 1980s when he had an office in New York, and I went to see him because I had read The 12th Planet, and I felt that he was really on the track
mm-hmm.
important, having to do with the Anunnaki. For people who hear that word and think that somebody has made this up, no. The Anunnaki is carved in cuneiform on stone tablets 5,000 years ago in what is now modern-day Iran and Iraq and was then Mesopotamia. This is hard archaeological fact. The Anunnaki were described on those stone tablets, and now here we get into the different interpretations. Zechariah Sitchin wrote The 12th Planet from his analysis of the cuneiform. Academics will argue with each other, as well as Zechariah Sitchin, and say a translation of the cuneiform doesn't mean X, it means Y. So now we're down to the problem that George, you and I would wager 99% of the American population cannot read and translate 5,000-year-old cuneiform on tablets. We are completely dependent upon people who have studied their whole life, and there aren't many who have studied cuneiform to do translations. Now, Zechariah has devoted a lot of his life to studying cuneiform, and he has done a series of books, and he does the drawings, and he shows the stones, and I've gone to the British Museum in London. I have gone to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I have looked at many of the similar or same cuneiform or where they would take a stone or carve it and then roll it in clay. And then you will get these pictures that Zechariah has drawn in his books that he is doing the translations in and around those pictures. And his bottom line is that the Mesopotamian Sumer civilization left all of this stone-carved language work about an Anunnaki who were non-human from some other star system who came to this planet and for a period of time cohabited in that part of the world in the Middle East with humans and taught them they learned about farming and metallurgy, and the list is very long. All of that is in those carved stones from Zechariah Sitchin's point of view. Now, I will share the most interesting question and response that I had with him was this. we had been talking about animal mutilations mm-hmm. and Mesopotamia, and I said, Zechariah, have you ever worked in the past, or are you working now in the present for any intelligence agency in the United States? And there was this very long pause. And he looked at me with his blue eyes through those magnifying round glass lenses that he's always worn. And he said, even if I were, I couldn't answer your question. And I've often wondered, did he start the 12th planet because the government is over a barrel? How to explain to the world, let alone the United States population, that they have knowledge that the Mesopotamian world, once upon a time, had cohabitation with extraterrestrial biological entities.
What a story. First time caller line, let's go to Stefania in New York. Hi there.
Hi. I have so many things to say. The thing I told you, your screener, the Roswell Rock and the crop circles.
Okay, go ahead.
I haven't seen the website, so I haven't really seen the pictures of what they look like, but I had this thought before, and then, Linda, you said this, how if you could lay the rock on top of the crop circles that it would fit. So I had this thought, well, what if somebody recreated the crop circle on another rock that was also iron and silica? And because the one gentleman you were talking to had said that, you know, somebody who really knew how to do it could do it, but that they couldn't see any marking of tools, but yet it could be done.
Right.
So if you were to make another one the same size and at the same exact scale as the rock, but with the pattern of the crop circle and also maybe taking into consideration the swirls, the direction of the swirls in the crop circle, maybe being the positive-negative aspect of it, you know, spinning one direction clockwise one side, counterclockwise the other, and put them together, maybe see what happens.
Meaning, would some gigantic crop formation manifest somewhere in a field in the world?
No. I think you misunderstood. No, I was saying to get another rock. I mean, because it's a natural occurring rock, this iron and silica rock, right, that the carving is on. So to get another rock like that, just a plain one. Like I said, I haven't seen the picture, so maybe I should have before I called
that. Yeah, go to Earth Files and take a look at the three parts that I've done on the science, on the crop formation, and on Robert Ridge, and then get back in touch with me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Email me what you're describing after you've looked at the website.
I've got to tell you, just to look at the similarities there between the rock and the original crop formation. Absolutely riveting.
Right.
What a mind, if it was created here as a hoax, what a mind to come up with that, Linda.
Well, and I would say that the professor says this hard, iron-rich rock that he's examined very carefully is not anything that would be easy to make such a refined, beveled pattern in.
Unbelievable. Hey, Linda, we're going to come right back. We're going to take more of your phone calls. Where's your next trip? Do we ever run into you at a conference or so?
Well, let's see. The next two conferences coming up are November, Chet Snow's down in Tempe, Arizona, and then Ryan Wood's wonderful conference in Las Vegas that we did the fun radio interview.
I remember that. That was fun.
And we always try to say we would do it again, and it hasn't happened, but I will be there in November.
Okay, and we may be out there too. Stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls in this Fast Night with Linda Moulton Howe. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got conversations with Linda, and to the phones we go. West of the Rockies, Megan, you're on the air. Hi, Megan.
Hi, this is Megan calling from Temecula. It's so exciting to speak with both of you.
Thank you.
And that is in California, for those who don't know.
There you go. I'm a beekeeper, and I actually have a couple of bee comments and a question for you, Linda.
Right.
There's a gentleman that I work with who is a third-generation beekeeper. He has had some experience working bees on tobacco. Both his grandfather and his father had been contracted to work with tobacco pollination. They apparently requires a fair amount of hand pollination, and the bees don't really want to work the tobacco, and they had brought bees in specifically to do that. What they found was that after the second or third day of working the tobacco, the bees can't find their way back to the hive.
Right.
They get lost. They're just out, and they never come back. And my question was, has any work really been done with the genetic modification where they've taken the tobacco specifically for the bug protection and modified other plants for that? Do we have any experimenting with that to see if that's part of the problem, since it seems to cause memory loss in the bees?
It's you're asking a good question about a very specific kind of research, but I can say that the broader box are the neonicotinoid pesticides. They are a nicotine-based pesticide. They've only been on the commercial world market for about a decade, and they came in with all kinds of promises of being less lethal, hanging around less, and their consumption just grew. There were more and more demands until, I think it was France first and Italy. The farmers actually went in to protest against the government saying, these nicotine-based pesticides are killing our bees. We don't want them. We get them away from our countries. And France and Italy have drawn really strict laws. Now, what we have found in the United States since colony collapse disorder, there was preliminary research before CCD became a horribly big problem that showed that even at the very smallest measurable doses of neonicotinoid pesticide, it would affect the bees' ability to go out and come back. That it really affects their nervous systems, their minds. It completely blocks it, and they can't find their way back. So we knew that there was that kind of preliminary research, but nobody had any idea whether or not the massive disappearance of the honeybees in the United States and in some provinces in Canada could be related directly to that pesticide. And when I have talked with scientists who have been studying so many aspects of this, from the viruses to the food to all kinds of things, they say that there is not yet what they call a verifiable lab smoking gun. The neonicotinoid pesticides are way up there on the list of problems for bees no matter what. It's very clear that a nicotine-based pesticide is going to hurt bees no matter where they are. And now I think that there is kind of a larger growing issue in front of not just the American population but around the world. Where do we draw the line as nations, as people, as local communities on what can be just wholesale placed on food and on soils, because we don't know what all the consequences are? This definitely applies to genetically modified crops.
Mm-hmm.
It's this other big, huge issue on the world today that includes harm probably not only to bees but a lot of other things. So we have so many tracks now with nicotine-based pesticides, genetically modified crops, fumigation of soils. There's just a long list that goes on. The viruses, the various kinds of parasites on bees. It's a complex stew, but I think that you're going to the heart of an issue that has been very clear to a lot of people working in agriculture for a long time. You can't combine nicotine and bees and have the bees be able to go out and find the hive.
All right. Thanks, Linda, for that. Let's go to you, David, east of the Rockies in Ohio.
Yes, sir.
Hey, David.
You know, it seems, listening to your description of this stone in Ken Klein's work on the pyramids in Egypt, that there seems to be a similarity of patterns there of expressing, a message.
Well, the pyramids in Egypt, to me, is one big class of structure. We're talking about an iron-rich, hard little rock. It's only about 2 inches by 1.5 inches, so it's quite little. And the carving is unusual to begin with, but more so because it was only after Robert Ridge had the rock at home, was showing to his family and to some cousins, and there was somebody who was aware of CropCircleConnector.com. And they went and did a search because they remembered some kind of a pattern that reminded them of what was on Robert Ridge's stone. And that's how they found in the archives, Crop Circle Connector has an archive going back into the 90s of all the crop formations reported to them. And this one, on August 2nd, 1996, when you go back into CropCircleConnector.com archives and you read about what was being said that day and the days after this approximately 120-foot diameter formation was found in wheat at Lidington Castle, that the people who first got there reported that there was not a single sign of a broken stem, nothing mechanical, no tracks. This particular Lidington Castle formation with the crescent and the circle paired off inside of circles has always been on everyone's list of one of the most extraordinary crop formations of the last quarter century.
Let's go to Rob in California. Take it away, Rob. Thanks for calling.
Hey, George. It's Rob from L.A.
Yeah.
Hi, Linda. It's been a while since I spoke to you.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. This is a wonderful piece of fossil here, this rock. I've been looking on your website, earthfiles.com, and this is amazing. This falls probably in the category of if you're familiar with quirks, they're basically impossible fossils that date back hundreds of millions of years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, such as a Canadian fossil that was found of a human fingerprint, embedded, that was 110 years old. And then we have another one that was in Delta, Utah, of a shoe imprint in shale of 300 to 600 million years old. So this object here, what I would do is carbon date this thing and try to find out exactly how old it is, because a lot of these, like, there's UFOs seen around crop circles, so there's no surprise about the UFO phenomenon versus crop circles. And this device, this object, appears to be very old. So that may tell you that a UFO phenomenon may not be from our future, but from our past, maybe around 110 million years ago. They may have left elsewhere, found another habitable planet better than ours. Like what we do is we move around the planet, find a nice climate, like California. Maybe they evolved and found a new solar system to live on. They visit us once in a while and make these crop circles to tell us that they were here before.
Well,
I'd carbon date this thing.
I don't know. I can certainly ask the professor to see if there is any technique we could use on this particular composition of stone. But I will say that in that area around Capitan Mountain, it's famous for strong winds. And there's lots and lots of shifting sands and shifting soil because there is a lot of strong wind periodically. And when you think that if this was buried, how deep was it buried? How long did it take for this to suddenly emerge? Because as Robert Ridge said, I've been going there a lot of times, and there are deer hunters there every year. And this is something that if it had been there before, probably somebody would have seen it. And why it suddenly popped up in September of 2004 might relate to the fact that it is windy there. And maybe it was exposed. And what you're asking is this something that is old and that was buried and was exposed? Or the other side is it something new that somebody made on purpose to plant there? And we don't know the answer yet, except that Robert Ridge strongly feels that this is not something that somebody planted to be found. Because as he said, my gosh, the idea that something would be dropped there for somebody to find, it might take 100 years for somebody to stumble across it. So this is truly a mysterious rock in a mysterious part of New Mexico that has this history going back to 1947 of at least three strange wedge-shaped vehicles crashing in an area, one of which, one of the crash sites, was only 17 miles from where he found this strange rock.
And you can't carbon date rock, Linda, so that's going to make it even harder.
That's what I, that, on this particular case, it's an iron silicon rock. That's why I said I could ask the professor to see if there's anything that could be done. But in terms of carbon, you'd have to go to the very, you'd have to go to the strata that the rock was found in the soil before you could date it.
Yeah, exactly. Let's take a few more calls here. Michael in North Carolina, welcome to the program, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, guys.
Sure.
Great show. Linda, first I'd like to thank you for kind of turning me on to all the kind of stuff that George talks about with your Alien Harvest book. My mom bought it from me when I was like 13 years old back in like 89 or something.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it was a signed copy, so I was kind of thumbs up. Thanks, Mom. But
that was my first book, An Alien Harvest.
Yep. And I knew about you way before all this and Coast to Coast and anything. Anyways, I have something really important to say, and I want everybody in the audience to really perk up, especially engineers, anybody very familiar with computers and 3D modeling. A while ago, maybe about 5 months ago, I was watching YouTube and seeing all the different videos that people were using on creating certain radial arrays of magnets to interact with one another to create free energy somehow, okay? And people are experimenting here and there, and there's a large community of people doing this online. And at the same time, I'm seeing this huge flap of crop circles appearing up to like three a day now,
mm-hmm.
all across Europe mostly. And I was like, you know what? There's got to be something here. I mean, this is just too ridiculous. We're being idiots not to really take this seriously, okay? I mean, people can scoff it off or whatever, say it's aliens or people with boards. I don't care. There's something very important in this. People are decoding it. That guy in Australia is doing all the math with it.
Right.
And so I started correlating the two. I look at one – I have two monitors here. I have crop circles on one and free energy devices on the other, and I'm looking at the simulators. I'm like, what the heck? Bang. And then you come out with your thing just recently with your rock – and you're watching it rotate, I'm just like, it's solid evidence right here. What is interesting is the, you said the kind of interlocking, the reverse image of the depressed crop being the enlarged area of the rock. Take this into consideration. I've been trying to do these types of things for the past 5 months, and I've just been seething with, like, adrenaline, be like, oh, my God, this is the next big thing. But everybody needs to work on it together. Not just one corporation can own it, because you can't patent these designs. They're just out there in nature.
Right.
What people need to do, I think, is get some kind of fine cement, okay? Mill it with a large amount of milled granular iron and silica, okay? Make molds. Take the there's a website, x-cosmos.com. It has a huge thing, a library of all these images. People actually make the geometrical diagrams of them for safekeeping, you know, for records. Take those. Make 3D objects out of them. Have them stereolithograph. This is printing 3D objects through stereolithography for rapid prototyping. Get those made on a small scale. Make plaster molds out of those, okay? Pour in this concrete, highly ionized concrete thing with different, you know, augmented areas. Have them interact with a, you know, large magnets. See if we can get some serious spinning going on. If we can do that, we can spin a rotor and we can have some electricity device. What if the biggest question that we have right now, the biggest problem the planet has right now, okay, is energy. If we could just power a bunch of lights for free to grow a bunch of food indoors, you know, you could eat. If you could power one of these new atmospheric water generators, you could have free water.
Well, what do you think, Linda? We're going to run out of time here, but I want to get your reaction.
It's a fertile mind, and he is
asking
good questions. And I think that if there is light at the end of the tunnel in this country now, it is the growing excitement at all ages, all sexes, all minds, all professions, about how can we break the fossil fuel hold and move off into alternative energy systems, some of which may not have been invented yet, and that what he's suggesting is that all around us for 25 years have been these remarkable patterns in crop formations around the world. Nobody has understood why, to what end, by whom, for what agenda. The Australian scientist who has done a lot of study has been convinced for the last few years that it has been a mathematical language embedded in a lot of these patterns related to astronomical cycles. Why? Something is trying to catch our attention and make us look at something that is outside of the Earth or on the Earth. And right now, I understand what he means, and the issue always comes up, how much money would it cost to make the experimental molds that you are discussing? And that is one of the stumbling blocks that so many people have right now in trying to push ideas into real experimental research. If anybody listening has any other ideas about what has just been described, email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Who knows, George? It may be that, like popcorn popping, that it will not just be solar and wind, that there may be all kinds of new energy systems that are just about to break.
I had Edgar Mitchell on earlier this week, and he, of course, hails from Roswell, New Mexico, when he was younger. And we talked about the story that has gone all around the planet about him and his belief in extraterrestrials, and he cleared things up, things he's been saying on this program, Linda, for years. He said, George, I haven't said anything different.
That's right. That's why I was surprised. I put at Earth Files, it's Kerrang Radio out of the West Midlands in UK that interviewed him.
Yeah.
And I went to their website and did a complete transcript of his interview and put it at Earth Files, thinking that I was going to encounter information that I had not heard in some way before.
You already had it. Hey, Linda, we're out of time. We'll see you again in another month, okay?
Yes. Stay safe, everybody.
Linda Moltenau. For Kara Scoburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.